The Bible reading for today comes from Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 to 15. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labour. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well.
Did you see the tomatoes on the way in this morning? There's a great big box of tomatoes there, which are surplus from our community garden. And you're welcome to take a bag full of them. And I saw Oscar, one of the young guys here at the church, just hopping into a tomato, and he was really enjoying it. It was great to see. So they're beautiful tomatoes, without blemish. They look really fantastic. So by all means, take some on your way out today. If you're a gardener, it is a great time of year, isn't it? Especially if you're into your productive garden, vegetable garden, you just know this time of year, it's harvest time. You get this glut of harvest, and it's just a fantastic, like, it's a time of abundance and plenty, and it's just wonderful. At least it is for some people, but not for everyone, as I look at the faces going. Anyway, I know in our garden, it's that time of year to some degree. Our veggie garden is not very productive at the moment. We plant at this time of year for winter. We find that's a better way of doing it. Someone I know gave me a great tip along those lines, and it's worked very well because you don't have to put as much water on it, and it's a water-saving measure. And anyway, I won't go on too much. But at the moment, we're in harvest with our grapes. We've got about 9 grapevines. I've got a little, I call it Chateau Crothers, a sort of mini winery happening there. Now, the grapes were planted about 3 or 4 years ago. You need to wait till about 5 or 7 years before they become any good for actually harvesting, for the point of view of using them to create a wine that tastes anything like actual wine and not some awful vinegar. But we're working towards that objective down the track. And so, 9 grapevines, it's not going to produce very much, but there'll be enough there to sort of muck around and have a bit of fun with in a few years' time. But it's harvest time at the moment with our grapes. And so it's a really exciting time because you see the grapes and the grapes. I've got the purple ones, Cabernet grapes, and you see them, these tiny little grapes, and they go change colour, and you know they're getting ready, and you pick one off and just taste it. You know, it's a bit sour, it's not quite right. And it's a real trick in harvesting grapes, I've found. Now, if you're not a lazy gardener like I am, then you put netting over your grapes and you protect them and all that sort of stuff. But I'm a lazy gardener, at least at the moment, because time's precious and I don't have time to do all that sort of stuff. So it's really important that you get the timing right, because if you leave it too long, then the birds are going to come and they'll harvest for you and finish it off well and truly. But if you pick them too soon, then they're no good. And they're actually quite good eating grapes. They're not as good as sultana grapes or that sort of stuff, but they're not bad, you know, they're good. And you can pick them at just the right time. But you've got about 24 hours, I reckon. 24 hours before they're ripe and ready to go, and then before when the birds come and take them. You know, timing is everything. And the experienced gardener or experienced farmer knows how important timing is when it comes to harvest. And they know that the harvest time is not always going to be at exactly that time of year, because we're subject to the vagaries of the weather and the rain and various other conditions, the amount of sunshine and so on. And so sometimes harvest is earlier, sometimes it's late. I know with grapes, you know, my grapes are anywhere from the start of March through to mid to late April. And the good, experienced farmer knows the right time to harvest. Today I'm actually talking about timing, about understanding God's timing. I think it's an aspect of following Jesus that we often make mistakes around in understanding God's timing, because it's one thing to know God's will for your life, but it's another thing entirely to be able to do God's will in his time, in his way. Now, there's three times in my life where I've experienced real frustration, like deep, genuine frustration, because I had a sense where I knew God's will, and yet somehow I couldn't get hold of his timing and couldn't understand how God was working that out. One of those times was in my 20s when I was single before Kate. And for most of my 20s, I was single. Now, admittedly, I had a few false starts, and we won't go into that too much. But most of that time, I was single and waiting. I knew that I wasn't meant to be on my own. I knew that God must have had a plan for that area of my life, because it just wasn't right. I was lonely. But I had to wait. And it was frustrating waiting. Sometimes opportunities would present themselves, but they were with girls that weren't honouring of God in their own lives. And so, you know, I had these great girls, but you just knew there was one aspect of their lives which where there wasn't compatibility. And it was a difficult, challenging time, knowing a sense of God's will, but waiting for his plan to unfold. I can remember another time when I was volunteering as a youth leader in my early 20s and getting a sense of God was calling me into ministry, and having a sense that it was a vocational call, and it was more than just volunteering, it was something more than that. And you know, that's not for everyone, but that was what God was saying to me at the time. And so I was starting to think, you know, I want to step into that. I've taken myself off to get theological training, so I was working through theological studies and volunteering almost 20 hours a week in the church and seeing God do great things. And the church that I was a part of at the time was Crossway Baptist Church. It was a large church. They had a youth pastoral team. There was about four or five people on that youth pastoral team. They were all doing an amazing job at the time. There was no sense that there was ever going to be any opportunity come, because these people were in place and they were God's people for that time. And I felt God was not asking me to go anywhere else but to stay where I was, but yet there seemed to be a ceiling. I couldn't get through, and yet I felt God start to say to me, you know, he's calling me into vocational paid ministry at Crossway. But the opportunities weren't there. So what do you do with that? I couldn't go and tell anyone about it. I couldn't go and say, look, start paying me. You know, you can't have that conversation. It's not right to have that conversation. I just had to wait. And I waited. And I waited some more. And then eventually, quite miraculously, the youth staff team that were doing a great job for all sorts of different reasons, God moved a number of them on at the same time into various other ministries, different opportunities, and all of a sudden, there were vacancies, and the person responsible for the ministry came to me and said, you know, I'm wondering if God's been saying anything to you about, you know, coming on staff. Like, you know, yes, yes. There was another time, and in a similar way, it was at the end of my time of being a youth minister. I'd been a youth minister for 8 years. By this stage, I was a different church, and for a whole lot of different reasons, it had become right and appropriate for me to step down for that role, and I went into construction and as a way of just earning some income and stepping out of ministry for a while because I needed a break from it and various other things going on. And over a period of 12 months, that first 12 months being in construction, I was about discerning what it was God had for me and Kate and our family. And over that 12 months, we realised that God, quite unexpectedly actually, it wasn't on our radar at all, was calling us to take on a church that was established, that had been going for some time, that maybe wanted to move towards engaging with its community and being more missional and so on. But it was established, a normal church. And so we thought, well, there's plenty of those churches out there. I'm theologically trained. I've got 8 years of ministry experience, a couple of big churches. They're going to fall over themselves to get a piece of me. And so I waited. And I waited. And I waited some more. And the doors just didn't open up for all sorts of different reasons. Again, a whole lot of false starts, something like 15 different job applications or conversations that happened in that time before Gisborne Church of Christ came. And the rest, I say, is history. Well, You're stuck with me now. Over the last couple of years, probably 4 or 5 years actually, I've been involved in what's called the Endorsement Task Force of the Church of Christ of Victoria and Tasmania, which is a task force responsible for, I guess, recognising and discerning whether people are suitable or not for ministry. And so in order for someone to become an endorsed minister of the Church of Christ in Victoria and Tasmania, there's a process which they need to go through, and I'm on the task force that's responsible for overseeing that process. And over the last few years, I've had so many conversations with emerging leaders, people that know that they're called to ministry. And every single one of those conversations have identified some sort of gap, some sort of place between knowing God's call or having a sense of what God's call is, but the door not fully being opened for them. Really fascinating. Every single conversation can identify some sort of gap, some sort of sense of frustration, some sort of sense of, where's God in this? God seems to be distant, almost like a desert experience for them. Now, for some, this gap is only a few months, and for others, it's years, even decades. Today, we're continuing our series on Moses. We're in week 3 of our series. It's a series that's going to go for about 15 weeks. And because we're coming in and out of it, it'll take us through to the end of this year by the time we've worked through it. We see a really tragic story that Joe's read out to us before. Tragic story where a man is killed. And as a result of the murder that Moses has committed, he flees. He flees off to Midian. He flees off to his own desert experience. One that would last him 40 years. What I want to do today is work through this passage, almost verse by verse. And then at the end of it, we're going to look at what we can apply and what we can learn today. So Moses was born an Israelite, but he grew up as an Egyptian. He was the slave boy who became a prince. He was a charismatic leader, we've discovered over the last couple of weeks. Someone that could lead Egypt. He was the future heir to the throne. He was a military conqueror, led Egypt to a great victory, military victory over Ethiopia that meant that he was held in high esteem whenever he went. We're told and we know that he was impressive in his appearance. He was a good-looking man, that he was highly educated. He was Egyptian royalty through and through. Except as he approaches the age of 40, there's something that nags away at him. He knows deep down that he's not really an Egyptian. He's an Israelite by birth, a Hebrew. He's one of God's chosen people. But I think that there's something else happening here, something more happening for Moses at this point in time. Because as he begins to realize that he's an Israelite, a Hebrew, as he begins, he realizes that he's one of God's chosen people. As he reflects on his upbringing and his circumstances up until this point in time, maybe God has a plan in this. Maybe God has a purpose. Even he's starting to sense a calling. I mean, why else wasn't he killed along with all the other Israelite boys when he was born? But he wasn't. He was spared. Why didn't he grow up a slave instead of a prince? Why didn't he have a life of hard labour instead of being highly educated? There's a whole lot of circumstances and things happening here that maybe God has a special plan for him. Maybe God has a special purpose. And I think emerging within Moses is this same sense that his mum and dad had the day he was born. God has set him aside. God is going to do something through him. God has a special plan for him. He's going to use him to lead the Israelites out of slavery, out of bondage, into freedom. Now, of course, Moses was right. He had discerned what God's will for him actually was. But he makes a big mistake. Because it's one thing to know the will of God. It's another thing entirely to do God's will in his time, with his leading, in his way. when I went through Bible college, there was a lecturer there. He was a really interesting guy, a big guy. And when he was lecturing us, he would have been, you know, probably mid to late 50s, something like that. But big and powerful man, you know, impressive and quite intimidating. He'd come out of the armed services. That was his background. In fact, he'd been an SAS soldier. Now, he'd gone to Vietnam and seen a battle in Vietnam. And one of the things about people that the soldiers that get to that sort of level of fighting is that they are trained in combat. They know how to kill a person with their bare hands. They just know what to do, what's needed to do. It's part of their training. And so it was for this person. And because he had seen military conflict in Vietnam, he'd been involved in some things that scarred him emotionally. And so when he came home, he had nothing to do and didn't know nothing about civilian life settled him. So he ended up becoming a mercenary, fighting all over the world for foreign powers that would pay him money in order to do it, because there was just nothing else he knew how to do or what to do. And eventually, though, God touched his life and God's grace came into his life and an incredible change started to happen. He ended up being a missionary and later on was a Bible college lecturer. An incredible story about God's grace. But when you are sitting there in his lectures, you always listen very intently, because you didn't want to do anything wrong, just in case he was tempted to use some of those skills that he learned. But also because coming through everything he said was this incredible, powerful story of God's grace. He was a hard man, seeing some things that hopefully I'll never see and hopefully none of us will ever see. But because of God's grace, he was a hard man who'd become soft. Soft to the Spirit of God and to his leading. When Moses comes across this Egyptian beating a Hebrew, his blood boils. And we see verse 12, you know, what does he do? Well, he sort of looks this way, he looks that way, and he sees there's no one there. And so he strikes the Egyptian. Now, Moses was a military leader. He had been trained in hand-to-hand combat. He knew exactly what he'd do. He could have knocked the guy out and given him a bad headache. This was not some irrational act of rage here. It was rage, but it wasn't irrational. He knew exactly what he was doing. He looks this way, looks that. He knows what's needed to be done. If he wants to kill the man, he can do it. And he does. He commits murder. The next day he comes out and he comes across these two Hebrews that are fighting each other, and he tries to exert some leadership into this situation. He's trying to live into his calling that God has. He knows that God wants him to be the leader of the Israelites, so he's trying to demonstrate leadership, and he says to them, you know, why are you hitting out at each other? And straight away they point out his hypocrisy to him. Are you going to kill us too? Just like you killed the Egyptian? And in that instant, Moses' world is shattered. People know. Word's got out. They know what he's done. Not only has he rejected his upbringing, his royalness, his inheritance, all that he was entitled to as an Egyptian, in order to side with the Israelites, to start living into the person that God had created him to be, he was now a murderer of an Egyptian. And as word got out, the inevitable happened. Pharaoh finds out. And there's only one response. Moses must be put to death for this. But before that happened, Moses flees. He's off to Midian. He's going as far away from Egypt, from Pharaoh and from the Israelites as he possibly can get. And at this point, it's all gone wrong. God's call. God's plan. The leader of the Israelites? Well, not now. Not ever, so it seems. It's dashed. Moses is finished. Now, most of us know the story of Moses, and we know that the story doesn't actually end there. Because Moses settles in Midian, he marries into a local family, he becomes a shepherd, he lives a quiet life for the next 40 years until one day he sees a bush that's on fire but it's not burning. He goes closer and he hears God's voice, he takes his shoes off and God renews his call to Moses. But that's for next week. For now, we're going to focus on the lessons from this passage today. So I'm convinced that Moses first became aware of God's plan for his life long before the burning bush. And the passage that we're in today, while not stating it explicitly, implies it in strong terms. See, it says he went out to his people. He saw the Egyptian beating one of his own people. Moses is already starting to recognize when he see those terms his and own that they're not just his people, but he's meant to be the leader here. And he sees the injustice that's happening with the way the Egyptians are treating his people, and he recognizes his unique upbringing and place, and he knows that God has called him to do something, and in the desire to respond, something just overcomes him. Kills a man. It's a despicable act. There's no excuse for it. But we need to recognize that his intentions were honorable, albeit misplaced. You see, the root of Moses' problem was this. He dedicated himself to the will of God, but not to the God whose will it was. He dedicated himself to the will of God, but not to the God whose will it was. I believe this passage is speaking directly to a group of people here today. It might not be a big group, probably is a small group. And this particular group of people that will be with us today will have some sense of God's will, some sense of God's calling in their lives. But also a sense, and it carries with it frustration, that that calling, that will is not yet fully realized. They haven't yet been able to step into what God has for them. And it's not because of lack of trying. It's just that the right doors haven't opened up. There seems to be this period of waiting, and it's frustrating. Now, for some people here today, it may be, like me, some sense of vocational calling where the doors just haven't opened up yet. For others, it might be a calling to another vocation. Maybe a builder, maybe someone in IT, maybe a teacher, whatever it is. And that is equally as valid as a call to ministry. And for whatever reason, those doors haven't opened up. Maybe for some, it's that desire that you know that you're not meant to be on your own. Maybe there's a partner for me somewhere. For others, maybe it's the desire to have kids, and that hasn't been able to happen yet. There's lots of different reasons why we find ourselves in Midian, in the desert, in the gap between a sense of call and it not yet being fully realized. I shared earlier about some of my experience where I went and worked in construction as a labourer. When I started, I was on my wage salary little docket thing that you got. My description at the start was unskilled labourer, which was a very apt and adequate description for the skills in which I brought to the job. Now, I noticed, and I don't know when it happened, but somewhere along the way, that title was changed. After a year or so, it became skilled labourer. I'm bringing some things here. This is good. But whenever I went to work, I got up very early in the morning, as construction workers do, and I tried to remind myself of another title, one that I'd given myself, not one that had appeared on any wages docket or employment contract. Title that I had given myself was that I'm a minister to construction workers. Even though God's calling wasn't quite opening up for me, I was still committed to trying to live into that wherever I was. After that period of waiting, some 2 years, and it doesn't seem like very long now, but gee, it felt like a long time at the time. Gisborne Church of Christ came calling, and we came. And after about 2 years of being here at the church, first couple of years we were living in the house next door, and we'd bought a block of land, and we went through the process of building a house, and we invited some friends up from Melbourne to come and see us. And one of my friends that came was very familiar with my story, and we know each other really well, and I'd shared a lot of the struggle with him, and so he was familiar with the difficulty and the challenge and the frustrating time that I'd been through waiting for God's right opportunity to open up. And he said to me, as we were inspecting the house, but it wasn't just about the house, it was about where I was at and the space I was in, emotionally, spiritually, and environmentally. And he says, "You're in clover." And I said, "What, like a cow?" And we laughed about that, but he was right. He was right. I was in that place of God's blessing, the center of God's plan and purpose for my life. And it was an incredible experience after having had that time of frustration and difficulty. When I look back at that time of being in the desert, I remember how often, and it was too often, I would look ahead to what could be, what might be. And it would only give me frustration. And hindsight's a wonderful thing, because as I look back, I can see if I'd just been able to live in the moment a bit more, I would have seen how God was really at work there. Because I can see now the time of that desert time being so powerful in terms of preparation, in terms of lessons learned, in terms of God revealing his way and his purposes, even though he didn't feel particularly close at the time. I can look back now and be incredibly thankful for that time. I want to finish today by asking three questions. And they're particularly relevant if you find yourself in this space of being in the desert, between the sense of calling and the full realization of it. And the three questions will be up on the screen behind me as we work through them. And these are, I guess, reflections of my own desert time and perhaps ways in which you can maximize the time of the desert if this is where you find yourself in right now. So the first question is this: how do I maximize the extra time the desert experience gives me to nurture my relationship with God? That is, how do I get to know the God who wills, not just the will of God? One of the things about desert experiences, not always but often, is it allows you extra time. You're not quite as busy as what you will be when you're in clover. Or you have time available to use to nurture your relationship with God. So for me, as a labourer, a lot of the role was pretty mundane, pretty boring. It was an opportunity to pray a lot. And I did, and I was able to nurture an intimacy with God in that time that I wouldn't have otherwise been able during times of busyness in serving God. Second question is, how can I be serving God now in my area of passion and calling? Even if it's in a seemingly small and insignificant way. And I shared about my own job title that I'd given myself just before. Third question is, when I observe someone in clover, what can I learn from them? When I observe someone in clover, what can I learn from them? One of my experiences was that at this time of working in construction, Kate and I and our very small family at that stage, it was Maria and eventually Tom came along, was that we attended a church called Kilsyth South Baptist Church. Great church. And the minister there, Tim, his name was, brilliant guy, still there. He's doing a great job. That church has just grown. Great ministry coming out of that church. And you know, I've got to say, I looked upon Tim with a lot of envy. I couldn't help it. You know, he was in clover. But boy, did I learn a lot. Learned so much from him. There were other guys that I looked at in ministry and observed, and both from previous experiences and people that I knew, and realised that there were some things about what they were doing that I wouldn't do. different things. Oh, it wasn't quite where God was leading me. And it was a really helpful time to observe others in ministry and work out what it was that God was saying to me specifically in terms of how he was leading me. And so 10 years ago, almost to the day, actually it was probably a bit less than that, 8 or 9, but almost to the day, Kate and I sat down. No, I think it was 10 years, 2007 it was, so 10 years. We sat down, that's 10 years, isn't it? 10 years? It's 2017 now, isn't it? I keep forgetting. It's a long time ago, 10 years ago, almost to the day. We sat down and we actually, between us, prayerfully came up with some values that we would like to see in the church that we would be a part of one day. This is a long time before we even knew Gisborne Church of Christ was on the radar. Now, interestingly, we had a bit of a sense of where God was leading us. See, we had been eastern suburbs kids. We grew up in the eastern suburbs in what's known as the Bible Belt. You know, there's big churches out in the eastern suburbs. And the article, I think it's in The Age this morning, about one church, you know, over 5,000 people coming through its doors every Sunday. And there's a lot of churches that are like that, really big churches. Lots of churches, all that sort of stuff. That's the environment that we grew up in, and we wanted out. You know, it was the sense where God was leading us out of that into something else. And we even thought that God was leading us somewhere to either the north of Melbourne or the west of Melbourne, maybe western suburbs, maybe northern suburbs, maybe regional, we're not sure. But we had a bit of a geographical sense. And so when the Churches of Christ rang me, and the guy on the phone from head office says, oh, we don't really have any churches at the moment, but there's just this one that's in Gisborne, but no one from out your way is even interested in it. And I'm going, hang on. God's already been saying something about that to us. And just so happens, you know, Gisborne's regional, northwest of Melbourne. You know, it's bang, smack in the middle of what God was saying. And so we'd come up with these values. And so when we had the discussion with Gisborne Church of Christ about the sort of values that they had and we had, and we saw that there was alignment, it was a really exciting thing. And nearly, if we can go to that next slide, I just want to share what those values are, if we can see that. I think it's getting cut off a little bit, isn't it? So we called it our Chook Church. We had a sense that part of what God was leading us was actually to something more, you know, we didn't know quite how to articulate at the time, but it was more of a sustainable way of doing life, being closer to the food that the produce and what we eat and all that sort of stuff. You know, it was all part of the package of where we felt God leading us. And you know, so when I came here at the church and there was a conversation about the community garden, yes, we're going to do that. That's great. And you look out there, it's amazing. So it's great things are happening. We called it our Chook Church because we also had the dream one day we'd have a block of land where we could own chooks, and it's all happened. It's wonderful. Here are the values. A community that places mission at its centre. We're there. We've articulated a vision. And the vision is there. We've done it together. It's not just me, but God has been leading us all in this direction. A community of people that actively contribute and are valued by the broader community. You know, we could honestly say at the moment that if we ceased to exist today, we would be missed. It's fantastic. A community that seeks to reproduce itself in other mission-centred churches. You know, we're not there yet, but we're talking about it. There's plans afoot. We'll get there one day. It's going to take time. It's a big thing, but it's starting to happen. We can see it bubbling up. A community that prioritises hospitality and table fellowship. Well, that was part of this church long before I came. And it's still being nurtured, and it's a wonderful thing. A community whose core business is discipleship. I actually don't like that terminology very much now, but that's what I wrote at the time, core business. But the priority on discipleship, you know, there's more we could do in that space, no doubt. But we've made gains, we've made progress. Stop it. My wife's crying. Aren't you? Yes, she is. A community that accepts others unconditionally, especially those on the margins, the vulnerable and the mentally unwell. You know, we're seeing this happen in pockets too. We're seeing you do it in your own networks and various places of work and volunteer involvement and all that sort of stuff. It's incredible. community that creates a permission-giving environment by giving people a go and developing leaders from within. That was part of our culture long before I came as well, and it's something that we continue to look and find ways of nurturing. But as I reflected on those core values, and I couldn't come away, but I was celebrating in my heart. You know, we're not there. I don't know if we'll ever be there. There's always more things. You know, God always has more for us. But isn't it God good? The way he can lead people. You know, it's not just me. He was leading a church towards this. He was leading me towards this. We happened to meet at the right time. And we've continued to work together and starting to see God do some amazing things. We're not there yet, but God is good. God is amazing.